interesting. You are quoted as being the nicest shark out there. This is wonderful. It's kind of a jackwagon. One of the toughest of sharks out there. Why do people consider you
the toughest? I would say he's the meanest.
But you know, being mean doesn't necessarily mean being tough. I think you can be nice and be tough. I think in life you can't be a pushover. You got to stand up for yourself. But I don't think that always equates to being mean. But you know, I thanks for saying that. But I don't think it's a very high bar on the chart. People often say to me, "You're the nice one," or "You're the good-looking one," and I'm like, "It's not a high bar. Trust me. It's not."
Yeah, you know, I find that
he lived in this, I mean, it's really well dramatic. I grew up in what is now a barn, but, you know, this little village with dirt floors, like, as extreme as you can imagine. But the crazy thing is, I didn't think we were poor. Because, you know, we had pigs, and we had dogs, and we had a cow, and I got to play in the hay. I mean, it was really cool. And everybody lived like I did. Then we come to Canada, and, you know, my mother was crying, and my dad was crying, and it was really awful. I'm like, I don't know why they're crying, because I'm on a boat, and this is really cool. And you have a bunk bed. How cool is that? And then the first day I go to school, because back then, they didn't teach you English, you just got thrown into it. So I'll never forget, I get thrown into it, I don't speak the language, and these kids are making fun of me. And I thought they were being really nice to me. I'm like, oh, look, all these kids are talking to me. I'm like, oh, no, they're being mean to me. And what I got out of it was they told me that I was poor. And I didn't know I was poor until somebody told me I was poor. And that's a very North American thing. I mean, the reality in this country is, and I don't care if you like money or you're not money motivated, but here's the reality in this country. You have to make a certain amount of money to take care of the people that you want. That is your responsibility. I don't care if you want to buy a nicer car or live in a bigger house. It doesn't matter what you want, but if you want to take care of the people you love in this country, you got to make a certain amount of money. And it really hit home for me, because in Yugoslavia, you know, it's a communist country. If you make a lot of money, they take it away from you. So the motivation is really gone. And my dad hated that. My dad used to tell me he was a political prisoner, which sounded really fancy. But he was a young guy, go to a bar, drink too much, and say bad things about communism. And you know what they do to you in a communist country when you stand up in a bar and say bad things about communism? They throw you in jail. And they threw him in jail again and again. And he got thrown in jail 22 times. And the last time he got thrown in jail, they said, if you come back, you will never come back. And they have places that they send you, and you don't exist anymore. There's no record. And, you know, I talked to my dad a lot about that when he got older. And it wasn't that he had a problem with the politics. He had the problem with working harder than the next person and then having it taken away. He didn't care if you don't want to work. If you want to live the way you want to live, my dad was okay with that. But if I'm willing to work 20 hours a day and break my back for my family, God help you if you're going to take that away. And that was his problem with communism.
Right. So now you grew up in Nova Scotia. Now, who was the biggest influence? Like, you have this really, and if you don't know him, he's very happy and very just optimistic. Where do you get that optimism from? Is it from your mother, your father, or just, you know, your whole upbringing, being, you know, having kind of struggle?
Yeah, I'm a pretty happy guy. I mean, I've always been a pretty happy guy. My dad wasn't real happy. You know, my dad wasn't the feely, fluffy kind of guy. He had a super, super hard life. So back in Yugoslavia, my dad was a very happy guy. He was an entertainer. He was a great singer. In fact, in my mind, I think I'm a great singer. So imagine that lifestyle, and you come to a foreign country, 37 years old, didn't speak the language, we have literally one suitcase with a $20, didn't know another living soul, and the only job he could get was sweeping floors in fact. And I don't know what was harder, the work or the demeaning attitude that everybody else looked down. I'll never know what was harder for my dad, the psychological hardship or just the physical hardship before me. And my mom wasn't real happy, but for me, I didn't have a lot, but I had the support of my mom and dad. And I think if Right? Because on those really crappy days when the world doesn't believe in you and you think there's no tomorrow, and you come home and it's your mom or your dad or somebody that makes you believe in yourself, that's all you need. And I think when really bad stuff happens to you, we as human beings go down one of two roads. And this road is external, meaning it's not my fault. It's this person. And we all know something. It's my boss. It's I went to the wrong school. It's my parents. It's. It's always an excuse. And the problem with that road is there's no end. Like if you start believing that you're a victim to circumstance in this life, where does it end? The other road is I'm responsible for everything. Good or bad, I'm not always responsible for what's happening to me in this moment, but I'm responsible for how I react to it. And I think for me, it was always like, I fundamentally believe tomorrow will be better than today. Because what's the alternative?
Thank you.
invest in that person and that idea.
Yeah, so who here watched Shark Tank?
Thank you. You know, in the first season, we thought it would never last. Seriously, at the end of the first season, we all had a big party, we all gave each other a hug. Barbara was completely inappropriate with her hugs. We thought we would never see each other again, and they picked it up again. In the first few seasons, we had to beg people to come on the show. Most of the time, the show. It's a really good show. And now, last season, we have 220,000 people on the show. We see about 208, and we probably see about 180. The show is absolutely real. We know nothing about them. There's a questionnaire you fill out that said, have you ever met one of the sharks? And if you've met them and pitched them, you can't get on the show.
And I tell them, they come up, you guys, a lot of people come up and give us stuff for you, and I'm like, hey, if you want to be on Shark Tank,
yeah. Wait, because we want to keep the level playing field with the other sharks. So we've never met them. We don't know their name. When the door opens, it's on. The average pitch is over an hour. No matter how long or short it gets cut, it's 7 minutes. And so, you know, we're just talking. There's no script. There's no, sometimes people get nervous and they're like, oh, can I do it again? They're not. Like, it's very real that way. But here's a funny thing that might surprise you. We know between the door opening and people coming out to stand on that bar and the first few words they say, we probably made up our mind 50% of the time. So we film 12 hours a day. We're cold because they have air conditioning blasting. We're hungry. We're miserable. They want us to fight with each other. We're thinking about who's paying for dinner. We haven't actually ever paid for dinner. And then, bam! You come. We're not sitting around going, oh my gosh, you're here. I'm so excited to see you. So it's how you, it's all the subtle, subconscious communication. There's a great saying in life, which is, people rarely remember what you say, but they remember how you make them feel. None of you here are going to go home and tell the significant other, yeah, I was a guy from Shark Tank, he was pretty good. Let me tell you the 20 things he said. But you're going to remember how you felt. It's the same thing with every human being you meet in life. People are too focused on the verbal communication. So they come out and they're like, I really want you to invest in me. You know, you've already lost us. Or they're not appropriately dressed. And by that, I don't mean that they're dressed nice or an expensive suit. You know, they're pitching a sporting outfit and they're wearing a suit. Or they're pitching something that's going to be sold to big corporations wearing a golf shirt. Like, it's right away there's a disconnect. I don't care what you look like. I care, do you support the product and the pitch that you're trying to make? That's a big one. How you stand is a big one. I got to tell you, if you're hunched over, you know what that's telling me is? You don't believe in yourself. If you're standing up and you're open, you believe in you. It's a tone of your voice. What? It's not my job to listen to you. It's your job to make me hear. And so, how do you make me hear? It's not the words that you use. It's the cadence, the language, how you dress, how you present yourself, all those things. And you'll see that on the show. Sometimes people come out, they don't know anything about accounting. And we're like, oh, don't worry about it. We have a whole accounting group. And then the next person will come out and say, I know nothing about accounting. And we're like, you're an idiot. How did you get here? It's all what happened in the first 2 minutes that you don't get to see.
That's great. I love it. Now let me ask you this. I'm staying on with Shark Tank. What has been your best investment? And what is your worst investment that you ever did on Shark Tank?
So it's been 10 years. It's been a lot of investments. them is a product called Tip Seals. And they made inappropriate, ugly Christmas sweaters. Forget this. I love this story because it drives for me one of the great things about our country, which is there is no shelf life or age restriction to a dream. You know, I think we all think that we have to do it when we're young. And if we don't do it when we're young, you know, the time is ticking by. Colonel Sanders didn't start his microprocessor until he was in his university. True story. There is no shelf life. There is no expiration for your dreams. There is no expiration for you wanting to better your life. There is no someday. Because you know what? That's not a real thing. If it can be done, do it now. Don't do it tomorrow. Don't do it Wednesday. Don't do it after your hair appointment on Friday. Do it today. Because you can start right now. So these guys come out. One guy's a dentist, and one guy's a lawyer. And they had a dream to start their own business. And so, I mean, being a dentist and lawyer is, you know, pretty good. And they just didn't like it. It wasn't their dream. So they wanted to start a business. They do a Google search on hot businesses to start. True story. And they find ugly Christmas sweater. So they're sitting around, they're going, we got to stand out in the ugly Christmas sweater market. So we're going to make inappropriate ugly Christmas sweater. So, like Santa peeing in the snow, Merry Christmas. Three reindeer doing it. So, they come out, and they're pitching this, and I swear, all five of us are like, why do I do this show? This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And they're pitching, and you know, they're really nice guys, and one shark said, the other shark said, the third shark said, fourth shark said, I'm still sitting there going, this is so stupid. And I'm literally about to go out, and they mention, hey, we have 600,000 in sales. I'm like, what? Tell me about it again. Up at that point, they had sold $600,000 worth of sales online. No salespeople, just the two of them. They're selling the sweaters for $70, bringing them in from China for $7. I'm losing my mind. I invest. That was five seasons ago, and we just passed $100 million in sales. So you're learning a lot about real stuff today. The message here should be, if somebody can make $100 million selling inappropriate ugly Christmas sweaters, what can they do with a low financial knowledge?
Well, let's stay on that. You talked about these guys being doctors, and you know, here I talk to them about specific knowledge, right? And you know, there's always this thing, especially on Wall Street, right? It's like, you know, you either went to Goldman Sachs and Harvard and all that. How much do you value success on going to like a Harvard or Yale, having that education versus specific knowledge education?
Let me take that back. I think if you have the opportunity and someone's paying for you, absolutely go to Harvard. Absolutely go to Yale. My kids never complain about the check I got for Stanford for them. Like, they're happy to go. What I've found, though, is here's an amazing stat. There's five sharks, six full-time sharks. Only one of us, and he's the poorest one, Kevin, has an MBA. Only half of us went farther than high school. Mark's degree, I think, is in drama. My degree is in classical English literature. Barbara doesn't know what her degree was in. Opportunity in life that many people don't.
court. And I didn't know anything. I knew enough to know that everybody around me was smarter, better educated, and came from a better family. So I didn't start out feeling that I'm competing with the kids from Yale or Harvard or Wall Street. I knew from the get-go they were farther ahead than I was. So I didn't want to catch up to them. I wanted to be better than them. And how do you... how do you get to be better than somebody who has $100,000 a year education? You know what it is? It's what you said. Narrow knowledge. I couldn't be better at this, but I could pick a narrow topic and gain knowledge in the world around. So I'm pretty good at a lot of things. You know, I'm pretty good at racing cars, this, that. But I'm pretty good at that. I'm great at dancing, that's good. But I'm great at cybersecurity. I think if you're farther down the totem pole of privilege in life, you've got to have a narrower set of knowledge. And you've got to really be good at that. You've got to immerse yourself in it. And you've got to have that level of knowledge that will get you past that point.
That's a great point. Now let's, I want to, this is something that comes up. And one thing I've been very fortunate enough to be able to travel with you guys, you know, Kevin and yourself and be on stage. And one thing, the one thing that I noticed the most about them is how hard you guys work. I mean, I feel like a slacker when I'm around them. They're always on their phones, they're always working, and the work ethic between you guys. And already a lot of people would say, hey, and I hear this all the time, if I had money, I would stop and be on the beach. And I say this to Kevin all the time, like, you have, you know, X amount of dollars, what are you doing? And these guys, it's not about the money, right?
Yeah, I always, you know, always people say that to me often. It's very important to say, well, if I had your kind of money, I would just stop. And in the back of my mind, I never say this, but I always think, well, if you think that way, you'll never have my kind of money. Which is really true. And hard work isn't a goal. Hard work is just, it's, you know, it's the key to get in. It's just par for the course. You know, my dad had a great saying, which was, if you don't work hard in life, you're going to be poor. But just because you work hard doesn't mean you're going to be rich. You're not here today to learn how to work harder. If you showed up here today and somebody needs to tell you that you have to work hard in life, yeah, it's like you're so far behind, it doesn't matter. But if you showed up here today to learn how to work hard and how to work smart, that's the key. Nobody worked harder than my dad. Two shifts in a factory, 4 to 5 days a week sweeping floors. That man couldn't have worked harder. He never got rich. But we weren't poor. We paid off our house. We had food on the table. I never had holes in my clothes. He was really proud of that. But the key is gaining that knowledge to take that work ethic and convert it to something that makes you money. You have to be earning money that is beyond what you get paid. If you work by the hour, guess what? You're never going to be wealthy. No one's going to pay you $1 million an hour. So you have to build something that gives you that level of knowledge where you can leverage that.
So now, thank you. So one more question, and we're going to go to a couple, two or three questions from the crowd that we got when you guys texted on this number. He gave up your number.
Oh, great.
But the last thing, and this goes on to what I see a lot, and what you're just talking about, is, and especially when people try to take control of their finances, it's the fear. There's so much fear that people have, they're afraid to take that leap, and you talk about fear all the time. Explain a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because we spend our whole lives trying to get to a safe place in life. And we think when we get to, you know, my mom was a receptionist and she hated stress. Like, she can't handle stress.
She used to say, when I retire, I will have no stress in my life. Because I won't be working anymore. I won't be dealing with those other crazy women at work. And then when she retired, she was just as stressed out as ever. Stress and fear never leave your life. Life actually doesn't get any easier. You just get stronger. And in that strength, you learn how to cope with these things. Fear has never left me. I am as afraid today as when I started out. It just, the stakes of fear are bigger. So when our company was smaller, I worried about losing $100 because it meant everything to me. Today, I'm about losing $1 million. And so you get bigger and bigger, but that fear never goes away. And I think it comes down to what you believe your fundamental purpose in life is. You know, fear for me is like a dark tunnel, and there's nobody there to hold your hand. I mean, you have those moments where you're going to be standing there, and it's dark. It's dark for every reason. It's dark in your life. And how do you move forward? How do you put that one foot ahead of the other? And I think it really comes down to what you believe your purpose in life is, and why you believe it.
We're going to get to the purpose in a second. You're going to hear this great story, but I want to get to two questions that the crowd brought in. And one is...
Yes, I am a great dancer.
That's what I'm saying. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. How you kept up with the dancing, and people want to know when you saw Kim for the first time. So I don't know if anybody here knows that he was on Dancing with the Stars. Pretty good job on Dancing with the Stars.
I think it was a little more than pretty good.
Well, he met his wife on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
So people, this one question is, did you know right from the beginning when you met Kim, was she...
Well, I think the audience could tell right away how lucky she was to have met. She made me smile. The moment I met her, she made me smile. And since that moment, she's always made me smile. And I always knew she was somebody that had incredible energy that I wanted to be with. Yeah.
And just to know that he had twins, what, 9 months ago?
4 months. 4 months. Because people recognize, I don't know the heavy lifting.
All right, so you talked about purpose, and there's a story that I love that you told when I first met you, and it's called you talk about Kevin, and this really meant a lot to me because we both are very close to our fathers. I lost my father. I love this story. Can you share it with the crowd?
Yeah. So I'm a big purpose guy. I've never been, like I said, the smartest guy in the room, the tallest, the best looking, the most educated. But do not do that, and I'll get up. Do not do that again, I'll get up. And I'll keep getting up until I can't stand. And I think it comes down from my purpose. And there is, everybody in this room has something that's important to you. You know, I don't care if it's a car, or a jet, or a nicer house, or your kid's education, or better medical. It doesn't matter what it is. But there's something to you that's personal that says to you, you've made it. Right? And it doesn't matter what other people think, it's to you. So when we came to Canada, my dad and I remember this so clear, we're walking down the street, and you see this thing coming down the road. And I come from a country where the hottest car was something called a Yugo. It was a piece of junk. They used to give them away in 2000 when you bought another car, and they still had excess inventory. So that was what we knew as a hot car. So I see this thing coming down the street, and I say to my dad, wow, what's that? My dad says, you know mine, that Cadillac. Like, what?
that moment, I had this, that was it for me, right? The affirmation. So years later, you know, I make a little bit of money, and I buy a nice car, I buy like a Mercedes, and I bring it to my dad's house, and I say, Mercedes, look at this star. And my dad would be like, it's nice. And then I buy a Rolls Royce and I bring it over and I'm like, Rolls Royce, handmade. Ooh. And my dad would be like, it's nice. So one day I call him and I say, look, I'm building a fence, you gotta help me, I'm the least handy guy in the world, come with me. So we're driving, this is a limo, and I pretend we get lost. My dad's like, you idiot! I went, oh, I'm so sorry, let's have a coffee. So we're in a coffee shop, and he's miserable. Like, it's August. He's this Eastern European guy wearing a fur baklava. And he's miserable because he's wearing fur in August. And we're in a coffee shop, and I'm like, there's a Cadillac dealership across the street. Let's go have a look. He's like, no! So we go across the street, and it's this massive Cadillac dealership. We open the door, and there's only one car in it. It's a Cadillac Sedan DeVille in a pearly white that only Cadillac makes. So we walk up to it, and my dad is just like, wow. I'm like, would you like to sit in it? And he's like, no, my pen's dirty. It's okay, sit down. And I open the door. He sits down and he puts his hands on the wheel. And man, I've got to tell you, all those years of pain and sacrifice and being thrown in jail and being made fun of and being spit on. But he touches that wheel and it just means something. And I say to him, what do you think? And he says, Bonnie Mae. And I say, today is the day.
Your Cadillac and you will never